Finance Division is in order. Make sure we get our right hat on for today. So I want to make a couple of clarifications. I'll try to remember to do this at the end also. But because we have two jurisdictions, when we go in and out of the Finance Division and the Policy Committee, technically there's completely separate meetings. And so members in particular, I will need to be aware that if they are here for one but not for the other, they'll be considered absent from the other meeting, at least if they aren't here at the beginning and checked in. So that said, why don't we jump right into the Board on Judicial Standards for our budget overview. Mr. Paul, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator.
Go ahead and just announce your name for the record, please.
Thank you. David S. Paul. I'm the Executive Secretary to the Board on Judicial Standards. I'd like to thank you and the committee for providing me this opportunity today to say a few words about the board, what it does, and also a few words in support of the governor's appropriation recommendation for the two-year appropriation. Also, I'd be very most pleased to answer all of your questions at this appearance also, if you have any. Special thanks to Cheryl for scheduling me in here at this terrific time, and I certainly appreciate that. This year, the governor has recommended that the board's operating budget remain the same as the last term. This is $456,000 for each of the next fiscal years. This would include the governor's recommendation that our revolving fund of $125,000 per annum be continued. The governor's recommendation parallels the request made to him by the board, and before I discuss why the board thinks this is a concept that this committee ought to support, let me just make a few comments about the board, its duties, its responsibilities, since, in my view, the two concepts are so closely tied. I also want to just point out before I launch into this is that I've given each member a brochure about our agency. It's nothing special about it. It's the brochure we send to members of the public. It's not really geared for legislators, but I think you might, if you get the chance to look at it, you might find it to be somewhat useful and somewhat interesting. Senator Limmer, how are you, sir? The Board on Judicial Standards is the only state agency that receives and processes complaints alleging that a Minnesota judge has engaged in judicial conduct or misconduct or wrongdoing. Our governing laws are at MS 490A, 0.01 and 0.02. The board also handles judicial disability matters. The board's mission is to protect the public by assuring that the judicial process is a fair one, impartial one, independent. It seeks to promote citizen recognition that the judiciary is an agency that is entitled to respect. The Board on Judicial Standards exists to provide citizens a process by which complaints are received and can be considered in order to continuously promote the public's trust and maintain their confidence in the legal system. In addition to the misconduct issues, the board makes judicial disability determinations. In this case, we decide, and I'm just quoting from our rules here because they're quite well descriptive, whether a judicial officer is suffering from a physical or mental condition that seriously interferes with the capacity of the judge to perform judicial duties, a fairly general definition. The board's jurisdiction includes many aspects of judges from all over the state, all district court judges, all district court referees, child support magistrate, active retired judges, Minnesota tax court judges, the appellate judges, workers' compensation court of appeals judges, again, limited to the appeals court, the entire general court of appeals, and, of course, the Supreme Court. The law also requires that the chief administrative law judge be generally accountable to the board in kind of an indirect way. The OAH chief law judge, pursuant to MS 14.48, is required to apply the code of judicial conduct, I'm quoting from the statute now, to the extent applicable and to judges under his supervision, and quoting again, in a manner consistent with interpretations made by the board on judicial standards. What this means is that the chief administrative law judge is obligated to enforce the rules and to do it in a way that is the way that the board would do it, and of course that requires him to consult with us. The board has a long, long history of cooperation between itself and the OAH on misconduct issues when they arise. In addition to processing these complaints, misconduct, disability, the agency engages in certain other activities within the operating portion of its funding. It reviews judges' compliance with Minnesota Law 546.27. This is basically the statute that requires that all decisions, whether it be on final decisions or motions, be rendered within a 90-day period from the date of submission. The law mandates that the board review these areas. The law also contains a number of other deadlines. The 90-day rule is just a representative of these, but it is the most often used, so that's the one we usually refer to as the 90-day rule. The board also researches and responds to inquiries from judges on matters of judicial ethics, the general public, legislature regarding the code on judicial conduct, and the judicial process. The agency does this principally by responding to phone calls, written complaints, written questions, emails, correspondence. The board has a separate kind of presentational aspect to its education duties. Speaks before our eyes, judges, lawyers, the general public about judicial ethics, seminars, conferences, briefings, literature, new judge orientation, etc. The board also reports to the Supreme Court. Of course, it reports to you, the legislature, and publishes its annual report every year. It prepares and processes all administrative and accounting functions, operations. And the board operates under certain rules. The legislature authorized the board's existence, authorized the Supreme Court to make rules to implement its activities. And the rules are in existence, and they were adopted first by the Supreme Court in 1971, but they were last revised in 2009. The most important thing to know about the board is the limit on its authority. Most important thing to remember. The board has power over judges and judicial officers only. No power over them acting in their capacity as decision makers, ruling on objections, ruling on the admissibility of evidence, issuing final orders. So what type of conduct does the board have power over? Almost everything except the judge acting in his or her decisional capacity, conflicts of interest, lack of impartiality, poor demeanor, lack of diligence, improper communication, failure to personally comply with when a board, when a judge gets a DWI or something like that, that's as well as a matter that deals with the law. Let me just give you a brief example just to help. We get a complaint that the judge's decision was incorrect. This is something that we can't deal with. Even where the complainant says that the judge was biased and the decision was incorrect, it's still not something that we can take authority over, because we always need something more than a ruling. A ruling and something else. A ruling and you're a black person. A ruling and you're a Latvian. A ruling and you cheated me at cards. Anything. Anything at all, but not just the ruling. Because, after all, judges are appointed and hired and elected to make rulings. An example of a personal complaint would be that the judge has a family connection to one of the parties. You know, this almost never happens, but things like this do happen. For example, if the judge was the father or the mother of a person contesting his or her criminal charge or something. It seems obvious, but this does take place on occasion. But you can see the difference. The personal stuff has nothing to do with the decision. You can make a decision which would favor a party or not favor a party. It has nothing to do with it. If it's personal conduct, it's within our jurisdiction. And, of course, the decisional conduct has everything to do with a decision. Rule 4C says that the board may not consider the actions of a judge acting to find facts, to apply the law as he or she understands those facts and those laws. That is the job of the court system, to review those types of things, our appellate system, not the board. Does this mean that judges do the right thing all the time? Decisions cannot be challenged or changed? Of course not. But one of the main reasons the board exists, and something that I deal with every day, is to promote recognition that such allegations relating to the nature of decisions, must be made to those who have the power to consider them, the power to change them. This in our society and in our system of government is only the judicial branch and the executive branches that have judges. Let me just say a word about our procedure. I don't want to go into it in very much detail. We can get a complaint from any source, the newspaper, an anonymous letter, anything. I do a review of these matters to see whether or not we have the authority over them. If we do, I process them as complaints. If we don't, then I reach out to the people who complain and try to explain to them why their complaint is not something that we can handle, and try to recommend alternatives for them. I do that same thing over the phone. The board eventually makes a decision on whether or not there is reasonable cause to pursue a case. If it does, it at that time notifies the judge of the existence of the complaint. If the board finds that there is actual misconduct, it will suggest to the judge or the judicial officer some form of discipline. The word punishment is not in our lexicon. We do not punish judges. We discipline, and with an eye not toward the judges, but with an eye toward the public and the public's view into the court. If the judge accepts the discipline, it is carried out. If the judge does not, or the judicial officer does not, there is a hearing held by a panel appointed by the Supreme Court. The hearing occurs within 90 days. There is a decision within 90 days after that. If either party, the judge or the board, is dissatisfied, the appeal goes to the Supreme Court. It makes the final decision. We have a Rule 11, which kind of sets out the parameters of our authority. We can suggest, propose. We can't issue these things unless the judge or the judicial officer agrees. We can suggest or propose public reprimand, public censure, civil penalty, suspension without pay, suspension with pay, retirement, removal, any combination of those types of things and types of things that fall in between. We can propose limitations on judicial behavior or performance conditions. All these are within the board's authority to propose, but if the case goes far enough, the Supreme Court has to enforce those eventually.
Mr. Paul, I didn't hear you say that you can suggest private reprimands or anything. Are there resolutions that would remain private if you determined that some form of discipline was warranted?
Thank you, Senator. That is, in fact, the case, that we do have the authority to discipline privately. It is one of the main ways in which the board acts, private discipline. Of course, private discipline is done because the misconduct is not serious enough to warrant public discipline, and the board still wants to make sure that the judge recognizes that and the judicial officer recognizes that some problem arose and that there's some reason to be concerned about the conduct
Mr. Chair.
Occurred. But I do appreciate that. I didn't mention it.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us an example of some of the things that would happen that you would do a private discipline on? What would be some of the subjects that are common?
Mr. Paul?
Chairman? I would be happy to do that. The board has a private admonition in its rules in which misconduct is set out carefully, and the judge or the judicial officer may not technically challenge it, although the judge or judicial officer has a opportunity to come before the board, a panel of board members, and just talk about it, discuss it, maybe suggest that the discipline is not warranted. But that is all private. The board can issue a letter of caution to a judge, which is not a disciplinary move, but it just lets the judge know that the board is concerned with something or other.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall?
I guess let me restate the question. What would be some of the reasons they would discipline for? What are some of the common reasons that are minor reasons that would be more of a private disciplinary.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Paul.
Minor demeanor problems, minor delayed case problems, lack of diligence, kind of mistaken, improper communications where perhaps a judge talks to a court expert or a court service provider out of the hearing of the other parties or without disclosing to the other parties. Many of these types of, and there are more, many of these types of violations are minor in nature and are quickly dealt with and usually never happen again.
Sure. Thank you.
Please continue.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just touch briefly on the establishment of our revolving appropriation because it's now about 5 years old, and I just want to let you know what the history of it is. Historically, a consistent priority issue for our agency has been the funding of expenses for investigations and for public hearings. It's always been a problem. If the board finds reasonable cause, and it does on rare occasions, but occasionally, in a matter involving a judicial officer for unethical conduct, it proposes a corrective measure or a series of corrective measures, and the judicial officer does not accept the board's proposal, a public hearing is demanded and is held. And like any, it's just like any legal proceeding, almost exactly. There are lawyers' fees, there are investigation costs, there are evidence duplication costs, there are court reporter costs, just normal costs involved with staging a public hearing. And they, of course, are not cheap, as none of this stuff is that's worthwhile. And the interesting thing is to recognize that the board is not really in control of this. It has no idea when it's going to be forced to organize its next public hearing. It has no idea when the judge is going to accept or not accept a particular proposal for a corrective measure. So predicting these costs has always been nigh onto impossible. They cannot be postponed. They're legal proceedings, and justice delayed is justice denied. And because of the deficiencies, they don't always fit neatly in the legislative timetable. They might occur when the legislature is not in session. So we can incur some deficits. And the board has made a deficit request to the legislature in every year that I have been here, and that's 14 years. To address these deficiencies in 2008, a separate revolving appropriation line item was established for this activity. The amount is $125,000 per year, and we don't spend it, which we almost always do in the first year. It can accumulate into the second. The funding has proven invaluable. In fiscal year 2008, we were experiencing a particular busy year with respect to public hearings. We had five cases going. Lawyer services were required in two. Investigative services were required in all of the rest. For those members who have been here in 2009 and 2011, you might recall that the board processed an unusually high number of public cases over those years. Again, the revolving funds proved to be invaluable. A new initiative has allowed the process to progress now without delay. It allows the board to pay sometimes all, but usually not, at least a healthy part of its expenses, its financial obligations for these hearings. Before, we could only get investigative services, for example, through lawyers because we'd had the money to pay for it, and the lawyers would advance it and then charge us back. Now we can do that for at least a lion's share of this, and I believe strongly that we have saved the state some money having the ability to contract for our own investigative services apart from the lawyers. We do have to still do some lawyer investigation, but it is reduced. Now, for 2013, we have asked the legislature to appropriate an additional deficiency amount of $300,000. The governor has recommended it. The deficiency request is related to three cases. One has already been publicly disclosed. I don't want to say too much about it. The hearing is coming in February 25th. The board's complaint is on the website. The judge's answer is also on the website. If you want to familiarize yourself with the type of case this is, you can certainly consult the website. We also have two disability matters, one which could be extended pursuant to Rule 16H. The judge has a right to a lawyer in these cases, and the judge has exercised his or her right in both of these cases, and so the board is paying for their lawyers, as the rules suggest. And the costs of these cases are very much like the costs of non-disability misconduct cases. They can be even more expensive because we are paying both sides of the legal advice area, and we also need medical experts, which can be expensive also. So how do I calculate how to estimate to you what I'm going to need? My method is quite straightforward. Over the years I've developed this, I compare the current case with past cases through objective means, how many days of hearing, the length of discovery, this type of thing. I then extrapolate the historical amounts to the current status of the case. This method has yielded extremely accurate results. We've never asked the legislature for two deficiency appropriations in a case. It's just one is all that's been necessary. So from that, I conclude that my estimates have been good. We also estimate from the lawyers, and we consider that. Let me just take an example of a well-publicized case. I don't want to center on any of these cases, but the Karasoff case in 2009 was a very well-publicized case. Started in 2009, the Supreme Court finally issued its ruling, final ruling in the case in 2011. It was 3 days of hearing. The total cost was $301,000. You can see where I just try to project from cases like this, and I use other cases too. Disability cases range from as little as $75,000 to as $300,000. Many years ago, we did a case with Judge Ginsburg, and it was a full-blown hearing where we were testing the existence of a disability, and that was a very expensive case. These cases can be expensive also. Let me just end with a couple of quick statistics, and then I would be more than happy to take your questions if there are any. In 2012, I processed approximately 1,100 phone calls, emails, and letters from the general public and from lawyers. I processed close to 150, actually over 150 inquiries from judges and judicial officers, mostly over the phone, but in some in writing. I recorded over 20,000 website inquiries. It was 18,000 in 2012. Issued several written advisory opinions and processed well over 100 written complaints. So that finishes my presentation. If there's any other questions, I'd be sure happy.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, your organization does very important work, especially if there's any accusation against a judge, to do it in a fair manner and yet protect the dignity of the court, at the same time ferreting into the charges. You brought up the situation about a $300,000 request due to the cost of some cases that are now before the board. My question is the request is for 2014, and is the $300,000, is this hurting your present budget right now? And why aren't you requesting a $300,000 emergency funding this year rather than wait for a whole new biennium?
Well,
Mr. Paul?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I think that the money requested would be available in July of 2013, I think. And we have paid up. We have enough money left to pay some on that. But the reason is that we don't know. We didn't feel that there was any way to get any money between this time and the end of the fiscal year, and all the people, the people who are waiting for the money, we haven't been fully billed on it, although we know what's coming. And it's just not going to be a problem if we, unless of course we didn't get the money in as requested. But we have kind of a grace period that we can contend with without
sure.
problem.
Senator Limmer.
Maybe this would be a more appropriate question for Mr. Turner. how can we expend funds that aren't committed in the next biennium? Is there, I don't understand that, the process on that.
Mr. Chairman?
Is that correct that one can use the money this year even though it's appropriated next year, if it is, in fact, appropriated next year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chairman. Limmer, from what I understand, Mr. Paul is going to budget accordingly this year. If we were to have an emergency appropriation now, it wouldn't become law. Where we're talking about the difference of a couple of months. If and right now, technically, we have no money in the budget by law. We have taken the surplus from this biennium, and it's been transferred into the reserves in the school shift. This seems to be a legal way to go about it.
All right. One other question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Paul, your office and my office have exchanged correspondence last year regarding records and record keeping and the destruction of minutes that involve cases involving judges. And if my recollection is correct, your board has stood by the premise that they have a right to destroy records, and it's been somewhat approved, that authority has been approved by the Supreme Court. Is that correct? Am I getting this correct?
Mr. Paul?
You know, I don't think it's accurate to say that the authority has been approved by the Supreme Court. The board did vote, a majority of board members did vote to destroy certain records which previous boards had determined should be kept. And before it, and it made this determination, but before it sought to implement this determination, it felt that it was would be helpful if it notified the Supreme Court of its intentions and asked them if they had any views or if they would be interested in weighing in any way. And the Supreme Court didn't approve that, and they didn't disapprove it. They just wrote back and said, we don't really think it's appropriate for us to intervene in this. So I to say that's approval by the Supreme Court, I don't think that would be quite the case, although it's certainly accurate to say that the Supreme Court did decide not to intervene in the board's decision.
Mr. Chair, the reason why I bring this up is I don't know if all the members of the public know that this organization considers charges against judges behind closed doors. The public is not invited. It sometimes is very close to a judicial proceeding behind those closed doors. And then to think that in an organization that makes its decisions in secret now are deciding to destroy records, it kind of makes me think that it's just a little too much. But Mr. Paul, maybe you could give me some parameters. Are these ancient records? Are these records of subjects that are already deceased or out of public life? Or could these records be destroyed within the career of a sitting judge? And how would one follow a repeat performance or a repeat accusation on a judge if those records were destroyed?
Mr. Paul?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer, you know, this process has been advancing, and let me just kind of briefly describe to you what we have done. It's just not a question of destruction. There is a portion of the rule which permits the chair of the board to order any records preserved just upon good cause shown. And we have studied all of these records now and have made determinations on a kind of a long list of criteria as to and made recommendations to the chair as to which ones of these records should be destroyed and which ones should not be destroyed. And we have the process has gone to such an extent that the chair has, in fact, made those decisions. And now, because the rule also requires that the judicial officer has to be informed before the records are destroyed or kept, and had a chance to, or at least informed that the board wants to keep those records, and have a chance to be to weigh in and to be heard, that is the stage we are at now. So the records are not quite destroyed, but we are at the point at which we are ready to contact judges and judicial officers whose records the board has decided to keep, and to give them an opportunity to have a say in that. And interestingly, I've heard from several judges already. Some judges want all their records to be preserved for various reasons. And think about it, there are several good reasons for that. And some judges, I think, would prefer to have their records destroyed. But that is the process over which the board has traveled in the past 6 months. So,
just going to note for the record that there is a quorum present at this time.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Paul, you stated that the chairman of the board has a criteria. Is that a written criteria? Is that a formal thing, or is it a kind of a judge? One judges this decision case by case, and even a most recent case could be destroyed. Is that correct?
Mr. Paul?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, we have come up with criteria in which to make this decision. The most recent case, you make reference to the most recent case. The rule does not even operate until after 3 years. So all cases are kept for at least a three-year period, and if other cases are discovered within the next three-year period, they can be extended for that period also. So it's not the most recent cases, but most of these cases are the older cases. And I think that I'm going to be very general right now, but generally speaking, having, of course, been present for the selection process, I think that most cases in which judges have committed misconduct that would fit into the criteria and would have been selected to be kept by the chairperson. There are reasons other than just the judge's record to keep some of these cases. Some of these are precedent setting. Some of them may be advanced, may be helpful to the board, these kinds of criteria. But generally speaking, I think we're talking about the older cases and not current cases.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
could you share with us by written form the criteria that the board uses to destroy records?
Mr. Paul?
Senator Limmer, I'm not sure if I can or not. The board's proceedings are confidential, and this might well be considered a board procedure. If you would permit me, I would ask and get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking is that the I can understand hearings on specific cases being non-public, but the criteria, how your organization establishes criteria to make judgment, I would think would be open to the public. And so that's my question, and I'd be somewhat surprised if even the rules of how you play in this board are under a veil as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
Senator Limmer, I serve the board, and I'm a cautious person when I do so, and I just want to make sure that I'm on solid ground when we discuss this further.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Mr. Paul, are there any circumstances under which the records that you may keep or destroy would become public or used in any capacity other than simply reviewing them for assistance in determining present cases?
Mr. Chairman, some of these records have become public already, which is one good reason to keep them. So I don't think that anything could happen to make these records become public other than the now that the cases are over. The decision to make a record become public is made by the board at the time that the cases are open, and when they close, the status of the case remains as it was at the time of closing. So the ones that have been disclosed to the public already would remain public, and the ones that have not been disclosed to the public would remain confidential.
So in what manner might records that you, for closed cases, be used for review, other than, say, by the board itself? Is there any other body, members of the public, for example, or outside parties that, if the records had been kept, might have access to those records to review the performance of the board or to review the history of a particular judge or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, no. The records are kept, in the first place, for the board's use. For example, the board may question what type of discipline to apply to a certain set of facts. It may look back at those at a case that is similar and see what it did. And of course, it's not bound by that, but it may draw guidance from an inquiry of that type. But the use of these records is for the board in the discharge of its duties.
So, for example, the Supreme Court couldn't in any particular instance say, board, we'd like to take a look back at how a case was handled 5 years ago. For whatever reason, the Supreme Court decides is appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, there is a way that the Supreme Court can establish a review of the board, but I'm not sure if it would actually extend to, reviewing the board's actual decisions. It would probably extend to the procedures employed by the board. Generally speaking, the board makes its decisions and the Supreme Court reviews those decisions in the proper case. And if there is no case, there's no review. The board makes its decision. Of course, nothing the board does is binding on anybody. Any issue that the judge has or a complainant has could be raised in a different setting. You can't say that because the board didn't find or did find that there's misconduct that it's somehow binding precedent. That's not what the board does. But the board's actual decisions, I think, would be not reviewable through an outside source unless challenged in the way that I had described earlier.
So, I sense sort of the direction of questioning Senator Limmer was going with is, if you destroy records, how are they available for anyone else outside of the agency to maybe someday review them and determine if appropriate conclusions were reached or if there are improprieties in the process or anything like that? The issues of public confidence in the decisions of the board and all that kind of thing would come up like they would in most agencies. So the reason I ask these questions are, the Board on Judicial Standards is unique in the way it's set up and in the access to its records and so on. So from what you're saying is that there really isn't any mechanism for outside judicial review of closed cases. The mechanism for outside judicial review is only in the process of while the case is still open, and if the judge and the board don't reach an agreement relating to the outcome or discipline in a particular case, then it's subject to the more public review process that would involve the Supreme Court's oversight. Am I paraphrasing it correctly?
Mr. Chairman, I think you are. I think that the records are for the use of the board, generally speaking. We don't have a procedure whereby the public can come in and view these records. And that which is publicized is the public has, of course, full rights to look at that. But because the board acts in two ways, in a confidential way, in a private way, and in a public way, yes, it wears two hats with respect to public disclosure.
And could you explain for the record then what is the principal purpose for maintaining the private nature of the board's activities in any particular case or generally?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the primary purpose is to preserve the respect and the integrity of the judiciary by not publicizing items of misconduct that are not very substantial or very serious. In other words, some things are in the view of the people who wrote the rules, which is the Supreme Court, various Supreme Courts in our state. There is some conduct which should be disciplined on a private basis, and it is because it does not work. Any time that you publicize something with respect to a judicial conduct, you're going to have an effect on the way the public looks at the judiciary. Now, this is okay when the misconduct is serious enough, but if it's not serious enough, there is a recognition that up to a certain level, the judiciary as an entity should not be subjected to this kind of criticism. So that's basically it.
I suspect part of that is the perception that even small, comparatively small, items of misconduct can be, to use a not very good term, overblown in the way they are portrayed in the media or interpreted by individuals. And the fear is that it might be overblown and have more of a negative impact on the perception of the judiciary than might or be more appropriate objectively.
Chairman, that is exactly correct. When we file a case publicly, you have to note that we never just file our complaint on the internet alone. We wait until the answer is received and we put them both on. We just, because it's a question of fairness. When you're dealing with the judiciary, there's always this balance. If misconduct is serious, it should be publicized, and certain types of discipline should be used. But if it's not serious, there is another whole aspect to the way the board does its work, and both have really salient effects on the judicial system. And there's just some things which are just not worth blowing up into a big thing. And you know, the board is appointed by the governor to make those decisions, and I'm appointed by the board to carry them on.
Senator
Mr.
Hall.
Chair, and if you don't know this, maybe council would. Do we have a similar thing to keep the respect of the Senate by not divulging small misconducts, or is this unique to their area?
Mr. Chairman, I think I might know the answer.
Mr. Paul, you know the answer. Go ahead.
I think that the board is a unique agency in that respect, Senator.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
I guess my question is why are they more unique than we would be in those situations? And do we legislate that? Have we made that the decision, or can we legislate so they can't do that? Is that something we can do?
Ponis, do you have any?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, first, Mr. Backus and I were just talking back and forth. I think for the Senate, like when there's an ethics complaint, people know about that. I mean, some of the deliberations are closed, but the existence of a complaint is public. And I think your next question was, could the law be changed?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the legislature does have broad authority under the Constitution to provide for the process for disciplinary removal of judges. In fact, what it has done is delegate most of that authority to the Supreme Court and the board through the rulemaking process. The statute itself is only about a page and a half long. It just creates the basic framework for the board. So most of it's in rules. So I suppose statutorily the legislature could do some things that would override what's in the rules.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Paul?
Senator, in further answer, there are periods of all complaints that we get where the judge does not even know that they were filed. There are some really good reasons for that. All 52 agencies, including ours, but all of our counterparts in the country have some, except for maybe two, have some confidential component at varying lengths because of these same types of considerations. And it's not that judges and judicial officers are any better or any worse than legislatures. It's the system. It's the judicial system that is sought to be protected. And so, you know, the idea is little items of misconduct can be used to chip away at the system when it wouldn't ordinarily be appropriate to do so or accurate to do so. And that's really the reason. I mean, I have a whole half-hour speech on confidentiality and its benefits and its problems. But that is one of the main components of the necessity for confidentiality.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. this is kind of an interesting conversation, trying to determine how co-equal the branches of government are. It kind of gives me a sense that some might be more co-equal than others. And especially with the treatment of ethical questions of different officers in each branch. Mr. Paul, on the issue of destroying records, is this board-created records, or would this be citizen complaints? Would that also be included in the allowance to destroy records? Would we be destroying citizen complaints as well?
Mr. Paul?
Yeah, the board would destroy all the records in a file, but there's nothing to prevent a citizen, and it happens, from publicizing their complaint. We have no control over that, nor do we seek any control over it. Citizens can publicize anything they want to. We have no reason to object. So although we would necessarily destroy all the records in a case, which we felt were appropriate, that does not mean that entire source of records, for that matter, would go away. The citizens, the people who make the complaints, sometimes lawyers, sometimes other judges make complaints, all would have the right to preserve their own records.
Mr. Chair, I'm just...
Senator Lemon.
This troubles me, this issue, and if I happen to be a citizen with what I thought would be a serious complaint, filed it into an organization that's not open to the public, and then that organization still wants to destroy the record, and let's say I die, my voice is snuffed out eternally. And there's no record of my complaint on a judge. So we don't need to belabor the subject anymore, but it just troubles me that we have a agency that for some reason in history is treated differently than other branches of government, simply because it's a different branch of government. I just have trouble with it, trying to think of this, and I would think there'd have to be a little bit more formal criteria. I can certainly understand ancient records that are perhaps a particular judge is retired now and there's no purpose to bring it up anymore, but or certainly if they've deceased, or maybe if the complainant is deceased. It's just a matter of discussion that you run into every once in a while and discussion in the legislature, and you kind of keep scratching your head. Why do we keep doing this?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
Your comments are very well taken. You might consider that, first of all, the judiciary stands apart from other agencies of the government because, you know, it actually makes rulings which decide people's rights. It really, you know, at the end, the legislature can pass the laws, the executive can carry them out, but it's the judiciary that really makes the decision as to when these laws apply and how they apply in it. To do that, the agency that does that must have certain attributes of integrity and impartiality and independence. There can be no suggestion that a judge is influenced improperly by one section of society or the other. And, you know, these are not requirements that are imposed on me as a citizen or on you as a legislator. Your job is to pass laws that you feel are appropriate, and you can do all kinds of things within that, other than break the law, you can do all kinds of things within that genre that helps you to do it. And it's appropriate behavior. It's preferred. It's necessary in some cases. But the judiciary is a different animal. It has to stand apart. It has to be independent. It has to be impartial. It has to have a special kind of integrity. And people have to see it that way. And that's why if there is different types of treatment, that I think it would be grounded in those types of aspects.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just also going to suggest that because of that that unique role that the judiciary plays in society, they are more susceptible to perhaps the wrong kinds of influence, complaints fabricated or overblown could be used as a sword to try to hound particular judges out of office or to influence their particular decisions in pending matters, for example, or in forthcoming matters. And I would expect the system is set up the way it is in part to try to insulate the judiciary from those kinds of pressures, which you and I and other legislators willingly and openly subject ourselves to every day, expecting even to be the subject of that kind of influence, or attempted influence.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
During this time of correspondence, it kind of got out to a number of judges. There were judges all the way from International Falls that called me, thinking that I wanted to destroy records that are on that board. And after talking to the district court judge up in that area, I assured him that I was on his side. But he was giving me some tremendous examples of why we should keep records. And so I think the judiciary is probably split on it. And there's reason for and reasons against. It's just that it's unique that it's in an organization that already has sealed doors when they make their decision. And then once they make that decision, now they can look around the room and go, hey, let's get rid of that file that we just talked about. And there's something wrong with that. It's a gut feel of mine, but nevertheless, it's good to have a discussion about it once in a while and try and understand why we're at the point that we are and if we want to continue.
Good discussion. Anything further from the committee on the board relating to this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank the committee. This has been a very, very interesting discussion and a very thoughtful discussion, and I appreciate it, and I'm sure the public does too.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. All right, now we will turn to the Department of Corrections budget overview. Commissioner Roy, welcome to the committee. And
Chair,
whoever you brought along with you, go ahead and proceed. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the invitation. I'm here with some very skilled staff today. To my right is Lisa Ogrosky. She is our assistant commissioner and is very skilled in the numbers. And I will open this presentation and set the plate because I think the context of this discussion is so important. We are always referencing our mission. And our mission is to reduce future crime. Every activity that we do is focused on that mission. Every dollar we spend is to that end. This particular slide is one that I've shared with a lot of people. And it is a slide that sets the context for everything that we're going to, that everything is going to follow here. And it's really important to note that we are 49th lowest state in the expenditure of general funds on correctional activities. At 2.7% of the general fund, the national average at 6.8%. We are 47th lowest in correctional staff as a percentage of state employees, 5.2%, with 11% of the national average. And here is kind of a non-related correctional statistic that you folks might use in other venues. But for every dollar that Minnesota spends on higher education, we only spend 17 cents. And this is absolutely the best ratio in the country. The national average is actually 60 cents on corrections for every dollar spent on higher education. And the worst state is $1.37, actually being spent more on corrections than higher ed. And what a sad comment that is on our society, that there are locations in this country that out of necessity have to spend more on corrections than they do higher education. The next slide is one that I could dwell on for many, many moments. In fact, I've had some suggestions that when this slide pops up, the brass band should burst through the doors and play Hallelujah. This is an example of government working, and it is no small example. And I wish I could claim ownership of this success, but this success started 30 years ago, and it is the product of some very forward-thinking legislators and corrections officials that set Minnesota on a new course of correctional delivery. And we'll hear some of that correctional delivery system. And it is remarkable. When I show this slide to other people around the country, other corrections administrators, they are often embarrassed by their own statistics, and they often follow up with me saying, how the heck does Minnesota do this?
And
could spend an hour talking about
Excuse
that.
Excuse me. May I ask you a question to repeat something?
Sure.
Because I'm still thinking about it, and I'm missing this hallelujah that you're talking about here, which is for every dollar Minnesota spends on higher education, with 17 cents on corrections. And then you went on to talk about how that's different from other states.
Yes, I did.
Would you repeat that portion of what you said?
Madam Chair, all the states are ranked with that ratio, and the worst state is Vermont, and they spend $1.37 on corrections per capita versus every dollar spent on corrections. So it's a ratio, not per capita. It's based just on their expenditure. The national average for all states is 60 cents spent on corrections for every dollar spent on higher education. So we're very proud of this statistic. We are 50th. We are absolutely...
I just need to know that when you look at that, is the overall amount of dollars spent in each state on higher education also different? The total number of dollars?
Madam Chair, yes, and there is a body of work behind these statistics that I could certainly share with you. But the ratio is really what I wanted to address, and it speaks to two things. It speaks to the really small amount that we spend on corrections, and it speaks to the significant investment that Minnesota makes in secondary education. So it's not all owned by corrections.
That's why I'm asking a question. I assume that if you dug in here further, you'd see that these states don't spend as much money on education and therefore spend more on corrections. That's the relationship.
I think that's a fair assessment, yes. So as the band quiets down here, I'm going to move into a more specific slide. And this compares us to our neighbor, Wisconsin. And I think this really is a significant slide as well. You can see that the demographics of Minnesota and Wisconsin are very similar. The first line, the second line, is where the demographics fall apart, and that is our prison population. More than twice as many in prison in Wisconsin. And obviously the next line is related to that. More than twice as many prisons. The spending rate per capita, also significantly different. and the rank of prison incarceration significantly different. The budget differences are significant. You can see that they spend more than twice as much as us on correctional prison placement. And I will get to the question why. Minnesota has committed to community corrections 30 years ago, and we committed to a sentencing guideline system 30 years ago or so. And those two are driving forces have left us in a very good posture. And I am very lucky to be sitting here today, commissioner of a system that's working. From this point on, Assistant Commissioner Ogrosky will talk about some of the more current interests of this committee, and that being the budget and the current proposals.
Madam Chair, members, this first slide just shows the governor's
proposal. Would you enter your name into the record, please?
Madam Chair, my name is Lisa Ogrosky. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Ogrosky.
This first slide shows the governor's proposed budget for fiscal years 14-15. Public safety is 5% of the budget, and of that, the Department of Corrections is 2.5%. The Department of Corrections has a lot of very efficient operations, and we're giving you a 10-year snapshot here. Our average prison population has increased 48% in the last 10 years, and the offenders we supervise on probation has increased 9%. However, we'd like to point out that our FTEs, our employees, have only increased 12% and our budget 26%. We've been successful because we've added beds to existing facilities, and we've also spent a great deal of time centralizing and regionalizing many of our administrative functions. We have three divisions in the agency: correctional institutions, which is 72% of our budget, community services, which is 23% of our budget, and operation support, which is 5%. In the community services division, 59% of that funding is actually pass-through money to locals. The governor is only recommending one change item for our agency, and it's a large one. It's $38 million. This funding is only to pay for our current staff. This does not add any additional staff. This is to pay for our current employees. If we don't get this money, we may have to lay off up to 273 employees by the end of the biennium. This estimate includes a 2% across-the-board increase that's already been negotiated, employer-paid health insurance increases, step increases, and FICA and other fringe. With this, we're also assuming a 4% vacancy rate, which is a bit trying for us. Historically, we've run a little more like a 2% vacancy rate the last couple years, closer to 4%. But we understand the state's difficult budget situation right now, and we need to be able to contribute whatever we can. So we're willing to push the envelope a bit and continue with this 4% vacancy rate, as painful as it might be. I also think it's important to note that this does not include any costs for future negotiated labor increases. So if the unions come in the next biennium and negotiate any further across-the-board increases, this does not include any funding for that. This slide just gives you a breakdown of employee compensation.
Excuse me, would you be willing to take a question at this time?
Absolutely.
Senator Deedson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going back to that 4% vacancy rate that is assumed. So I know with police and fire, because you do need to have a minimum standard, or you want to have a minimum number there. And so I'm assuming in the prisons, at least for prison staff that are dealing with the inmates, that's the same type of thing. So do you run into, do you then have higher overtime costs, or that will then impact your bottom line? Or is that vacancy rate spread out among more of the support staff where you may not need numbers? Because I know, like in the city of Minneapolis, if they have a vacancy rate here, which they may think is actually saving money once they start adding in the overtime because they have to fill that, their overtime goes like this. So just wondering.
Ms. Obrosky.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, that's a very good question. We try to fill our security positions as quickly as we possibly can, so we try to mitigate overtime. Overtime is another area we pay very, very, very close attention to, but you are correct. We do have a lot of post positions, in the facilities that have to be occupied. And if we are short-staffed, we have to pay overtime. More of our security positions that are vacant tend to be in the supervisor rank, where we can hold them open. We have vacancies in health services, behavioral health, education, some of the ones that you can open hold open a little longer to keep the savings. But we try very hard to fill the security positions as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Thank you. May I also ask a question as well, Ms. Obrowski? You have calculated in this a 9% increase in your health insurance costs. Can you help me understand what assumptions you have and why you've established that as a percent of increase? That seems high.
Certainly, Madam Chair. MMB did not give us specific instructions this year on what we should assume for health employer-paid health insurance costs, maybe, but we went historically back in our records, and in the past, MMB has recommended a 9%, and there's been differing increases in the past, sometimes ranging up to 13-14%, sometimes less than that, and so we tried to use what we believed was an adequate assumption to cover anything that might be higher or the second year might be lower.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. This chart actually just gives a breakout of the components of our employee compensation. Of course, 67% of that is salaries, 1% for workers' comp, overtime and premium, which is the shift differential for those who work late nights, is 2%, FICA 5. Our retirement contributions for non-correctional employee retirement plan staff is 1%, and for the corrections employees, 6%. Health insurance is 15%, and then we pay retirees insurance premiums for those who retire under that corrections employee retirement plan, and that's about $5.8 million a year. Some of the challenges we have with our budget and with our staffing is that we are 24/7 operations, and like Senator Desick mentioned, you know, we have to fill our post positions especially, and this can be very difficult. We have to have a body there, so we can't just leave many, many positions vacant. We have very limited ability to control our offender population, and in fact, we can't control intake at all. Last year, we had intake of over 7,300 offenders. We don't have alternative funding. We're kind of a unique state agency that way. We have very limited ability to generate any revenue. And so we're 95% general fund. And then we have the high cost of the corrections employee retirement plan. The employer contribution rate is 12.1% for their retirement versus 5% for the general plan. And about 70% of our employees are in that early retirement plan. And like I said previously, we pay for health insurance after age 55.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Ms. Ogrowski. Why is the corrections early retirement plan so much different than the general retirement plan? Do you know?
Do you know?
Senator Latz, Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Obviously, a negotiated settlement and a negotiated benefit. The police and fire plans were basic models for the correctional workers' retirement plan, and they're very similar. And there are pretty strict requirements to be a participant in that there is a high percentage of correctional officers because of the offender contact they have over the course of their workday, and that basically is the foundation for the SERP retirement plan, similar to police and fire.
So,
Senator Latz,
Madam Chair, Commissioner, it has to do with sort of the increased risk of involved in the job, the nature of the work.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, that is exactly the notion, that it is a highly stressful job, and at the end of careers, many corrections officers are pretty worn out. It's extremely stressful.
Thank you, Commissioner Roy. Please continue.
We're going to invite Terry Carlson, our Deputy Commissioner of Facilities, up to do the next part of the presentation.
go ahead, ma'am.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division. We were just talking about the Corrections Retirement Plan, and I just want to say a little bit about that volatile situation in our facilities. You may have seen on the news last night that we had an incident in one of our facilities, in our Stillwater facility, where several staff were injured, and their staff who have consistent contact with the offender population, and it was, a bad situation that involved just an unexpected, unruly, violent behavior. And our prisons are that. They're places that we do our best to maintain a safe environment for the staff and the offenders who work there, but they are dangerous places. Our goal is ultimately, in the Facilities Division, public safety through safe and humane incarceration of our adult and juvenile offenders, and also to provide research-based programming to, as Commissioner Roy said, provide opportunities for offenders to get out of prison and stay out, not come back committing new crimes. So we try to change their behavior. We try to motivate them to address their needs and their risks so they won't reoffend. This gives an overview of our Corrections Institution Division budget. As you can see, the largest component of this budget is in our facilities. It's for our security staff, our maintenance, and other staff in those facilities, as well as all the ongoing costs for utilities, for food preparation, for fuel, for supplies, and all of that. I'm going to be talking about the other components of this slide a little bit further into my presentation. So this picture portrays where our correctional facilities are located. We have 8 adult prisons and 2 juvenile facilities. For our adult system, we have a 5-level classification system. Our maximum security facility is at Oak Park Heights. We have 3 close custody or level 4 facilities, our St. Cloud facility, which is also our intake facility, Stillwater, and Rush City. We have 3 medium custody facilities at Faribault, Lino Lakes, and Moose Lake. And then we have minimum security units at Lino Lakes, Faribault, Stillwater, and Red Wing. Shakopee is our female facility. The capacity at that facility is 650. Just a point of fact, Faribault is our largest facility now with a capacity just over 2,000. Our juvenile facilities are at Red Wing and Togo. Red Wing houses between 120 and 130 serious juvenile offenders who are either committed to the Commissioner of Corrections or come to us on a condition of probation. And our Togo program houses between 20 and 30 juveniles who are more of an early intervention part in corrections. So it has a wilderness component and a lot of experiential learning. You can see the number of employees that we have in this division, and a good percentage of those are in the Corrections Retirement Plan.
It is no surprise,
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, thank you, that because of sentencing guidelines that exist in Minnesota, only offenders who have pretty significant criminal histories or commit crimes of a very serious nature, usually personal offenses, end up in our prison system. And the average history is noted here, and it should not surprise anybody that's familiar with the correction system. The next slide breaks that down a little further, and because of sentencing guidelines, over half of our offenders are engaged in some personal conduct or a crime that affects persons as a victim. And all crimes affect people, but where there's injury, robbery, what's considered person crimes. I think the other thing that we haven't really touched on and that I would just add to this slide is that almost our entire prison population of 9,500 recycles about every 3 years. We have a core of people doing long life sentences or long sentences, but 95% of our inmates will be back in our communities, usually within about 3 years. So it is extremely important that we do good work with them while we have them. The next slide, always we are interested in measuring what we do, and we're pretty proud of our outcome studies. We are especially proud that from our prisons we don't have escapes, and in some states it's, I won't say high rate of escapes, but a handful. And we are also very proud of our fugitive unit, that when an offender does go on the lam, and especially a sex offender, our fugitive unit is able to apprehend almost 100% of them within 72 hours. And in terms of public safety and public confidence in our system, this is a good statistic that we're very proud of, and those folks do good work at all times of day and night.
I'm going to continue with the next slide.
Ms. Carls.
Our health service unit includes medical services, dental, mental health, and treatment, sex offender and chemical dependency treatment. Most of our medical treatment is through ambulatory care type clinics, and is provided by the nursing staff and doctors that come into our facilities on a regular basis. With our chemical
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sherman.
I may have preempted you as you were going on. I'm sorry if I have, but I'm interested to know if you track or follow your recidivism rates for sex offenders and for in the area of. It's coming up, I take it. That's what I'm hearing from the sideline here. Anyway, I'd be interested to know very much. We heard some testimony this morning in Health and Human Services about a very low recidivism rate in level 2 and 3 offender, or 1 and 2 offenders, with a treatment methodology that you're using in the Department of Corrections. So I think it's fabulous. If that's the case, I'd like to hear more about it. And we need to collaborate between the treatment program at MSOP and corrections about how to address this problem. So that's why I'm asking you about it.
Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sherman, yes, that information is coming up, and we're very proud of our statistics and think that our programs do work, and our research shows that our programs do work. So we'll be talking about that in just a bit.
Okay, thank you.
Just a little bit more information about our chemical dependency treatment. We have about 860 residential beds for chemical dependency treatment, and 80% of our population in our adult facilities is directed to participate in chemical dependency treatment. Because we have only 860 beds, 30% of those who are directed to participate in treatment are able to participate. For sex offender treatment, we have approximately 350 beds in sex offender treatment, and in the last year, 205 offenders entered our treatment. The program is between 18 and 24 months, and so for sex offenders who need treatment in our system, approximately 20% receive treatment, and the remaining are assisted to get treatment when they return to the community. So, but we'll talk about the statistics of recidivism for those offenders who got treatment in an upcoming slide.
Sorry, Ms. Carlson, could you repeat the percentage that received the chemical dependency treatment?
So 30% of those who are directed to treatment are able to participate in treatment. And so this past year, we had just over 1,200 offenders enter CD treatment. That program is between 7 to 9 months long. It's a mastery-based program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sherman.
The 30% number, that the term you're using is directed. Does that mean that they're voluntarily seeking that and they're assessed in some way to be appropriate for that treatment program. And then the 30% indicates that the demand or the request from the incarcerated persons is much greater than you're able to resolve, to respond to.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Carlson.
Senator Sharon. About 90% of the offenders in our facilities have either substance abuse or chemical dependency, are assessed that way. And of that 90%, we look at those who need treatment most. Of course, there's about 80% of those who should get into treatment. Then we assess, again, those based on highest risk and highest need. And that's where we get to 30% actually participate. I hope I've clarified that for you.
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chairman, so you say you only have capacity for 30%, and so do you think the full 80% or up to 60%, or do you have an idea of how many would participate if there was extra capacity?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, I don't have a number that would, but our capacity is limited, and so people who need the treatment aren't able to get into it. If we had more treatment beds, we would fill them with people who need treatment.
And then one more final on this.
Senator Sharon.
Sorry. So are you able to demonstrate, because of what you are, and I'm assuming you're going to tell us about success for those 30% in terms of, in comparative to other approaches, that you have a low recidivism rate. Is that compared against the recidivism for incarceration of those who, if they'd gotten that treatment, ended up back in the correctional facility? And so, I mean, the reason I'm asking is that because, you know, it's the data that we really need to justify the expenditures for these programs that in the long run are going to save us some money if we if we do the proper intervention.
Ms. Carlson, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we are very confident that the statistics you will see, and we have a really robust research department that does peer-reviewed, validated research topics, and the results are impressive, and the full reports are available on our website, and they are very valid results that we're, and you will soon see the significant impact that treatment, not only in prison, but the best result then is if that treatment transitions into the community and it's continued in the community. It's not like you go to prison and get cured, hit the streets, and you're just fine. It needs to be a continuum of involvement.
Commissioner, where is it most cost-effective to deliver that treatment? In the facility or after they're released?
Mr. Chair, that cost comparison is difficult because of the duration. It's not common to have long duration treatments in the community. There are outpatient programs that function in most areas of the state that are far cheaper than a prison-based treatment. And I just don't feel qualified to answer your question in terms of return on investment.
Senator Sharon?
And then when maybe you'll be speaking to this. Sorry, we may be ahead of where you're in your presentation, but I'm interested to know, as you do early release planning, what I would call discharge planning out of my system, where you build a program for that offender that creates the assets they need in order to be successful. Are you having difficulty finding the resources to wrap around a chemically dependent person, an environment in which the probabilities are higher for success? Are you having difficulties finding community? Are there gaps in the community resources, and what are those when you get a chance to speak to those?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we actually have a major initiative called Transition from Prison to the Community, identifying those gaps in services. We're building coalitions around the state with treatment providers, aftercare, halfway houses, vocational people. Deputy Solheid will talk about that. But we are very cognizant of the need to involve the community upon release. We can't do it alone.
Go ahead and proceed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, do you use, with your chemical dependency program, do you use the 12-step program? Is that part of it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we use a program that was developed in consultation with Hazleton, and 12-step is part of that, and it is also part of the aftercare. There's a high expectation upon release on parole status that the 12-step AA be continued upon release as well.
Okay.
It's often a condition.
Good.
Mr. Things change quickly in the legislature.
Trouble.
Yep.
Trouble.
Ms. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, I just want to talk a little bit about education in our facilities. We offer not only the adult basic education for GED and high school diploma preparation, but also we offer post-secondary, some associate of arts work, as well as career and technical programs. At any given time, approximately one-third of our adult population is engaged in education programs within our facilities. Regarding MNCOR, that is our prison industry operations. It's been about 10 years that this program became self-sufficient. We have approximately 1,250 offenders participating in work programs in six of our facilities at any given time. And next in the Facility Services Division, I'll talk just a little bit about our Office of Special Investigations. Commissioner Roy mentioned the fugitive apprehensions. We have a unit of staff within our OSI, Office of Special Investigations, that works on those fugitive apprehensions. In the past couple of years, there have been about 400 apprehensions annually. We also have staff who conduct investigations of offender criminal behavior. During their incarceration, those staff also do monitoring of phones and mail and intelligence gathering and lots of work with regard to security threat groups, gang affiliations, and those kinds of things. Our Office of Special Investigations also has a role in the State Emergency Operations Center. And finally, in the Facilities Division, safety. We have safety directors at each of our facilities and also a whole safety presence within our agency within the Community Services Division as well. The focus is on, of course, safe work environments and promoting a safety culture to reduce injuries for staff. Within our agency, we have release planners who focus on mental health for the serious and persistent mentally ill offenders who...
Excuse me, Chair Lemmer, may I ask a question here?
Yes, Senator Schoen.
I'm a newbie to this committee, so I may have orientation issues here. But back on what you're talking about in terms of safety, do you follow a series of measures to indicate what your injury rate is, what the degree of injury is, what your workman compensation costs are in relationship to that? And do you use it as a dashboard in terms of making certain your interventions are, you're investing correctly there and having good outcomes?
Ms.
Question
Carlson.
One.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, we do. We work very closely with the Department of Administration and the MnSafe initiative, which sets up those benchmarks. I don't have the specific information off the top of my head, but... yes, we follow metrics, we review them, we are compared to other agencies, and workers' comp is included in that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that it'd be interesting also if you could tell me how we are doing in relationship to something, so that you're not just seeing this, but are we, we're going to expect some injury, so that's the high-risk population, but... when we ask people to work in difficult situations like this, I think that we should be clear if whether or not we are doing the very best we can to protect them from injury. And then my follow-up question, it doesn't have to be now, but I'm wondering what, if you're operating under different rules, obviously, in a prison system than we are in a security hospital situation. But the issue of injury with persons who, for a different reason, may have violent outbursts or difficulties occurring. But the injury rate, these injury rates for our employees in the state, whether it's in corrections or in the state-operated services, for the seriously mentally ill, we have to not only accept whatever rights people have, but we have to protect our employees.
Yes.
So I want to learn if you have some practices in the Department of Corrections, that if they can be applied over here or not. They may not be able to because the regulatory requirements of a hospital are different than they are for Department of Corrections. But this is an important issue. It's an expensive thing, and I don't think we should have people that are working for the state of Minnesota in this way be expecting to go into a dangerous place and not have some protection.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I can get the statistics for you. I just was talking with our safety director yesterday, and she reminded me that our highest incident rate is in the area of slips, trips, and falls, and staff assaults is 4 on that list, but I don't have the numbers that correspond with it, so I'll get that for you. We are so very concerned about staff safety and their health and wellness. We've started a couple of initiatives. One is our crisis intervention team training, which helps staff de-escalate situations with offenders who may be going through a mental health crisis. And so rather than having to jump in and use force, they're able to use their verbal de-escalation skills to calm the situation. And we see this as a great possibility for reducing the number of staff assaults that we have. So we're always looking to other ways to address that issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, release planners. We have release planners who focus on mental health, medical, traumatic brain injury, chemical dependency, and sex offender treatment. As you can see, they work with offenders to create comprehensive plans upon release so that they can be successful. They assist with enrolling in insurance, with medications, with healthcare providers, and community resources. So these are this is the slide that talks about the impact
Mr.
of our
Chair.
Treatment.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair. I have a question.
Senator Dietzick.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the release planners, so, and you might not have an answer for this, but as the Affordable Care Act and the exchange comes online, I know in like Hennepin County, so in the jail, we have issues of where people go in and out of jail, and so they're often on insurance or not, and so they, you know, they're not usually in jail long enough to get stabilized. But when they're in prison for a longer time, I'm assuming at least some of them are on certain medications, and especially those with mental health that are getting treatment get stabilized. Have we looked at, and I know I've talked to the affordable health care people, but have we looked at, or the ACA people, have we looked at to make sure, because when you are incarcerated, you will not qualify for the exchange, but are these release planners preparing and working with them to make sure that as they plan in advance of when these people will be released, that they don't go online and they're, you know, they're denied because they're still incarcerated, but that we have, you know, get that smooth transition so that when they're out, they can get insurance, and so then we don't have them falling, you know, they're stabilized, they don't get off the medication, and then the big cycle starts all over again.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, sitting next to me is our medical director, Nanette Larson, who is an expert in this area and can address the senator's concerns.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the department. Mr. Chair and Senator, our release planners do exactly that. One of their primary functions is to ensure that the offender, when they are released from us, gets enrolled in one of our health care programs, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare. They enroll them in all the Social Security programs, whether it's disability income or whatever. As we move forward with the Affordable Care Act and the insurance exchanges appear, they will be working with them as well. We've actually worked with DHS, and we have kind of our own nice little process and system to ensure that our guys are getting enrolled into one of those programs before they leave us for exactly the reasons that you said. We also, when we release our offenders, we release them with at least a 7-day supply of medication, if not more, as long as it's therapeutically safe. And then we also give them prescriptions for 30 days or more if we absolutely need to. So we are going to need to work with our practitioners as well to ensure that they get Medicaid numbers so that all that's going to be covered. So, yes, we're working with that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Carlson. Do they start
taking We're very cognizant of working within our limited resources, so we want to invest our money into programs that our research shows are effective. These are just some statistics, and like Commissioner Roy said earlier, all of our research studies are available on our website and provide much more in-depth information into the specifics for sex offender treatment, for our chemical dependency treatment. Our employee program, which is part of our prison industry program and helping offenders get jobs and keep those jobs when they get out. So just a snapshot of what is working well within our system.
Mr. Chair, arriving at the table is Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner for Community Services Division, and sometimes people don't understand what community services is. That's basically probation and parole. It's the other side of corrections, basically the two divisions, prison and community services.
Mr. Solheid.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner of Community Services, and I'm here to give you, in essence, an overview of how we provide those services in the community. First slide here just gives you an idea of our budget in the Community Services Division. We have a total budget of about $226.432 million. Of that, you can see that the majority is pass-through monies to counties, to our partners who are providing correctional services in the counties, both CCA and CPO. Additionally, we have other services that DOC provides out of the Community Services Division. You can see some of the units here and how they are funded with those dollars. Minnesota relies heavily on community supervision. I think this slide represents that. At present, there are about 5,200 offenders in the community that are on supervised release, or commonly referred to as parole in many cases. These are offenders that are out in the community statewide and are under supervision after having been released from prison. In addition, we have 116,000 adult and juvenile offenders on probation supervision statewide by the various agencies that provide for this supervision. This slide gives you a little breakdown on the various levels of offenses that they're under supervision for. Minnesota is a little unique in that we have three delivery systems. The Department of Corrections, being one of them, provides all felony supervision in 55 counties in the state, and contracts to provide services for adult misdemeanant and juveniles in 28 of those counties. County probation officers provide supervision in the other 27 of those counties for the adult misdemeanant and juveniles. And in the remaining 32 counties, there are 17 Community Corrections Act jurisdictions that provide for their own supervision and facility services, such as workhouse facilities in some of those counties. The next slide here gives you a breakdown of DOC probation supervision. DOC Field Services provides supervision to 18,205 on probation. This gives you a little breakdown on the types of offenses, person, property, drug, and other. We have DOC supervised release and parole offenders in those 55 counties as well, and we provide supervision to 1,492 of those individuals. Our Community Corrections Act partners who receive pass-through funding through the department, this gives you a breakdown of those that they supervise. They provide supervision to about 75% of the offenders, and they're primarily in the larger urban areas, Hennepin, Ramsey, Olmsted, St. Louis County, the larger metropolitan areas. So they provide supervision to the bulk of offenders on probation supervision, as well as they provide supervision to those on supervised release and or parole. Our county probation offices, they also provide supervision, like I said, in those 27 counties, and this gives you a breakdown of the 15,000 or so that they provide supervision for and the types of offenses that they are under supervision for. Performance measures that we do track in community services, again, 37% recidivism rate. Again, that's statewide for DOC. We do track restitution paid by discharge on offenders. That's a little different measure. And as you can see, it's dropped a little from 87% down to 82%, most likely due to the economy over the last couple of years that's kind of reducing the opportunity for offenders to pay. And then also we track the value of labor performed by our sentencing to service work crews statewide. A number of...
Mr. Chair? That STS, is that at all levels of supervision, or is it, you know, for misdemeanors in the district courts?
Mr. Chair, the sentencing to service program is county-level offenders typically, so it would be misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and some on felony supervision at the county level. And that's a partnership between the state and the counties in providing that as an alternative sentencing method for the courts.
All right. Thank you.
Additional responsibilities in the Community Services Division also include providing transitional housing and support for offenders being released from prison. We do provide some funding to house our highest risk offenders in community halfway houses and scattered site housing. The Risk Assessment Community Notification Unit assigns risk levels to predatory offenders being released from prison. And at present, there are about 287 level 3 offenders in Minnesota communities at the present time. In addition, we have about 17,000 offenders that are on active registered predatory offenders, 17,000 active registered predatory offenders in communities. And of those, 7,500 are subject to community notification. So if they move, change residences, we have to also include community notification as part of what we do.
So, Mr. Solheit, are you still on bullet point number 2 there relating to predatory offenders, or were you giving us some numbers also relating to level 3 sex offenders?
Both, actually. The level 3 sex offender is the 287 that are currently in the community throughout the state. The 17,000 are active registered predatory offenders. Not level 3s, but predatory offenders. So they have to register.
Right, but that's a broader category than just sex offenders, right?
Correct. Yes, it is.
But there are sex offenders within that group.
There are sex offenders within that group. They are not level 3 sex offenders. Another service we provide is we have a licensing or an inspection and enforcement unit that licenses and inspects county jail facilities, halfway houses, group homes, and also collaborates with the Department of Human Services. I know our inspection unit director was down providing technical assistance on security audits, as we do in our prison facilities, to the secure facilities both at Moose Lake and St. Peter with Department of Human Services. Other services we provide would be the Victims Services, which provides services to crime victims and their families. MinChoice is a collaboration between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety. It's an active website where victims and their families can go to find information on offenders, resources, and can also be notified, choose how they want to be notified when an offender is being released from prison or their custody status changes. We have a unit that manages grants and subsidies, pass-through dollars. As you noticed earlier, we provide a lot of money back to the counties through CCA and CPO funding, and that unit tracks those dollars as well as manages other grants and contracts that DOC provides for services in the community, such as sex offender treatment, remote alcohol monitoring services that are available for the counties to tap into for the offenders they supervise.
Senator Latz.
Senator Sharon.
On that, so if they're released from prison and they're in the community under a provisional release or something, then your budget continues to cover the costs of the treatment and the activities that are required of them during the provisional release or community release?
Just a lot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, we have some funding that goes toward outpatient sex offender treatment for approximately 1,900 offenders. I believe last year were served under that. So those are offenders that are in the community under probation or supervised release who are ordered to complete treatment in the community.
And are those, Senator Sharon. Thank you, are those who supervise that group, are they county probation agents or are they under the state's employment numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it would be a combination of both. They both tap into those resources.
And then one final question, and I'll be quiet. On the performance measures that you gave about recidivism, percent of offenders convicted of a new felony, do you do an analysis of what the contributing factors are to that for future investments? And could you give me an idea of what the couple of the top reasons are that you see reoffending?
Gisella.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the primary factors are risk characteristics that our offenders have. Chemical dependency contributes oftentimes to recidivism. Those with a history of violence, unemployment, housing needs, those are all characteristics that oftentimes contribute to recidivism in our offender population.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I missed some of this discussion, but I worked with SDS Cruz in Hennepin County, and I know they were very helpful. And especially when we had the tornado in North Minneapolis, I know we had SDS Cruz out there doing a lot of that heavy manual labor, helping just pick up and literally move tree trunks. And so they are very much appreciated in the community.
Senator Dietzick, thank you very much. We do really appreciate that program statewide. Getting back to the offender work crews, we do also have state minimum security inmates participating on work crews in the community as they are transitioning toward release. It was modeled after the sentencing to service program. As you can see here, in fiscal year 12, the dollar value of STS labor provided to state and local communities was estimated at approximately $5 million. And this is strictly those crews that are receiving some form of state funding. There are counties such as Hennepin that fund many more crews than state funding provides for. Work release is another program within Community Services Division. It's an early release program that allows select offenders to be employed as they transition from prison back into the community. About 600 offenders each year are released through or participate in the work release program. So on average, we have an average daily population of 200 offenders who are housed in halfway houses and county jail facilities. We contract with approximately 30 facilities around the state, and this does help free up prison beds. I think you heard Commissioner Carlson talk about the employee program that starts in the prisons. Offenders working in MnCorps jobs and vocational programming as they transition out into the community are also provided with services for up to a year post-release, where employee staff provide assistance with job search in the community as well as job retention while they are out in the community. And that does contribute greatly to the success that we've seen with that program.
Mr. Chair, I referenced the transition from prison to the community. We had a short video, but I'm very cognizant that behind me sit two very important people, Mr. Atkins and Mr. Hagstrom, and I know the committee's time is rather limited. Rather than show our video, I would defer to those gentlemen because I know their message to you is very important. And we fully recognize the importance of both the Community Corrections Act agencies and the county probation departments. They do tremendous work. And I referenced the slide when the band came in the room before. And the reason the band came in the room in large part is due to these gentlemen behind me. People that don't go to prison end up on supervision in the counties. And it is they are essential to our mission, and I would urge the committee to support them, hear their message, and recognize their unique role in our success. So thank you, committee, for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Why don't we welcome Tom Atkins and Bruce Hagstrom to the table. Make sure you sign in on the worksheet there, please, and the sign-up sheet, and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Tom Atkins from Washington County Community Corrections, and here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, otherwise known as MAC Act.
I'm Bruce Hagstrom, probation officer in Chisago County. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, and I'm here representing the CPO counties as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, I want to first of all thank you and the committee for asking us here to speak to this issue. I also want to thank the commissioner and his staff for framing the issue for us so well. It makes our job much easier. As the president of MACAC, I'm involved with the counties who are part of the CCA, the Community Corrections Act, who provide the full range of services similar to the Department of Corrections in local counties, from felony all the way down to juvenile misdemeanor and everything in between. We also are the counties who supervise those offenders who come out of prison in our counties. MACAC counties represent 17 jurisdictions, 32 counties across the state, and roughly 75% of the community-supervised offenders in the state, so if you're looking at probationers. The community supervision, as the commissioner has already laid out, is the backbone of Minnesota's system. It's how we keep that number low. And our community supervision at this point in time is where we know more about how to do that and how to do it well and effectively than ever in my career. And I've been at this for more than 30 years. But we do have a stranglehold on the ability to do it. If somebody asked me, do we have enough probation officers today? We have enough probation officers to do business the way we did 20 or 30 years ago. We don't have enough to implement all those effective practices. And I will talk a little bit more about that as we go. Projections for new prison beds is something that the legislature deals with on a regular basis. And I would hope as we move forward that you look at the MACAC counties and ask how can they, along with the DOC, work to keep those projections as low as possible for as long as possible out there. We're one of the keys to that, and it's one of the reasons that we can keep doing that. So before we expand prison beds down the road, I would hope that we, and it's not that we don't need prisons, we need those. We just need to make sure that the people that we can keep in the community safely are there and under the proper supervision to do that effectively. Probation costs roughly $4 a day in Washington County. If you take all of that, just a lump sum kind of figure, you can start to get the details and break out types of supervision. And we know that institutions are going to be much, much more expensive than that. If you're talking about $100 a day versus $4 a day, we want to maximize the use of those types of options before we get to that point. In 2011, there was about 1,624 mitigated departures. Those departures on the sentencing guidelines, and the commissioner referenced the sentencing guidelines, those in part aren't, they're not all related to what we do in CCA counties. But in part, that was what the vision of the Community Corrections Act was. If you develop local services, if you have options for judges, they will use those options locally instead of sending all those people to the state. The Commissioner of Corrections that was involved in that Community Corrections Act would have hoped that we wouldn't have a rush city at that point in time, but we would have alternatives to that. And the only way to have that happen is to keep investing in our local services. It is a partnership between the state and the counties. It's one that has worked at the service delivery well, extremely well. The funding is more of a challenge for us. One of the things that I would, if you go back and look at those 1,624 beds, they represented an average of 45.5 months on a sentence and 30.3 months of actual time served. That's over 4,000 prison beds that we save because we have departures. Now, a portion of those are related to the fact that we have options in Community Corrections Act counties. The Commissioner of Corrections, his former jurisdiction, has a very good correctional facility locally that provides a variety of treatment programs and alternatives that make it a good choice for judges locally to use when they're trying to decide do they send somebody to prison or not. Those kinds of options have grown over the years, but they will stagnate if we don't have the funds locally to keep those up. Dakota County, which was a county, I made the rounds a little bit over my 30 years. I started in Dakota County as a probation officer there, worked my way up to deputy director. At one point, I was an executive director for Arrowhead Regional Corrections. I'm currently with Washington County Community Corrections. And over the course of that time, I've seen jurisdictions do tremendous work. Dakota County has begun to measure some of the effectiveness of their groups that they deal with criminal thinking and behavior. We call them cognitive behavioral groups, but they're seeing, after 3 years, recidivism rates that for the people who participated in those, 61% are remaining crime-free, with about 50% who aren't. Those numbers start to add up. That's a pretty significant change in what would be if we weren't involved in those people's lives. So they make a difference when they go through those. One of the concerns I have that would be loudly represented if my county commissioners were here and if the rest of my MAC Act, directors were here would be the concern about the fat pass-through dollars to counties. It's been flat over the course of a decade. In my local budget, while the county has contributed another $1 million during that time, we have $9,000 of additional state funding. It's gone up, it's gone down a little bit, but it hasn't kept up and is leaving the counties to pick that up. Over that, when I got into this, when I started in Washington County, we were about a 50-50 mix, and that was pretty true for the partnership on state funding versus county funding. We're more like a 70-30 or less overall right now. We do have a good working relationship with the Commissioner of Corrections, but the funding model I would suggest to you, in my opinion, is broken for the pass-through dollars. It's broken despite having good governors over the years, good commissioners over the years, and good legislatures over the years. We have not had a voice at the table when it's time to fund community supervision in the state. Sometimes we're here, sometimes we get invited in, sometimes we get ourselves at the table, but we should be formally involved in this. Counties, and I'll just go with the CCA counties for a minute, $58 million comes from the state roughly. It's just a little bit less than that on an annual basis. So that $115 million pass-through to CCA counties, I'm working off of that number. Of that, we spend about $288 million the last time we looked for correctional services. So that share is a very critical part of that. We can't just think about those pass-through dollars as never going up. If those are stagnating, we're in deep trouble at the county level in trying to keep up with those. A small inflationary adjustment on this budget that at least matches what the overall Department of Corrections is doing would make a great deal of sense. If that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 4%, for CCA you're talking about roughly $4.5 million. For my counterparts over here in CPO, the county probation officers, that you're talking about another $500,000. If that were involved in this budget, then it would be commensurate for us on the field side. Instead, we're left right now having to face that problem without any additional state dollars. And that's a problem that's not going to go away easily. So long and short of it, that kind of money would do nothing but just keep us afloat at this point. It's not money that's going to change the world, but it does keep us afloat, and it keeps us from making additional cuts in our world. I'm going to leave you with three thoughts. One is, and I've mentioned each of these in one way or another, the first is that I would really request that we look at ways to address the funding model so that we have a seat at the table. We're a fairly large part of the correctional delivery system. We're a very large part of the field service delivery system. Secondly, that this budget would be added to for a similar, whatever the increase is going to be overall for the Department of Corrections, we look at that kind of an increase for the field services pass-through dollars. They're flat at the moment in this budget. And third is that we begin a more detailed, longer-term conversation about how we can work with you, work with the Department of Corrections, work with the governor to help avoid future prison bed costs. I think we're a key to that, but we're not going to be able to do it if we're anemically funded and anemically staffed to make that happen. So thank you for your time, and I very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Adkins, a question for you. By seat at the table, do you mean what you're doing today here, or is there something more that you had in mind?
I'm not sure what that looks like after 30 years in this business, plus, but right now we're coming in and there's already a budget on the table. And without getting earlier in that process and beginning to talk to the governor and getting some conversation where we're actually included in the initial budget processes, we're always trying to add into that. And I don't think that's going to make it happen. And I've seen enough good commissioners, and we think this commissioner's great. We love working with Mr. Roy.
Because of that connection to the Arrowhead region, I think, right?
There's the connection right there. But I So I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I think it has to come earlier in the process. So when the budget is laid out, we've relied on good commissioners year after year, and they are dealing with tremendous pressures to fund their own budget. It's pretty easy to leave that number flat. And so I think where that is in the process, we have to move it upstream, is I guess what I'm recommending.
Well, I would encourage you to work with the commissioner and with the governor's office, and that we get the process here a little later down the stream. So we appreciate your being here and your input here and now, and you're being heard certainly at the legislative part of the process. But we're going to have to leave it in your hands to work to swim upstream further.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We will do that. We will work on that issue, and I really do appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today.
The other question I had for you, and I guess we'll ask the same of Mr. Hagstrom, both of these questions, in terms of reducing prison beds, do you have any particular suggestions? Has the organization looked at putting together proposals to that effect?
The organization has talked about that and discussed that. I think one of the places to start talking about that is how do we help, and the legislature has asked questions about violators returning to prison. How do we help reduce that? It means that we have to look at some creative alternatives in those areas, and I think that would be one of the first places I would start. I think there's other places that the department and the MACAC could sit down and work at, coming up with some solutions that would continue to do that.
Well, we would certainly welcome anything you'd like to submit to this committee in connection with that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Hagstrom.
Chairman Letts, members of the committee, I can add to what Tom was saying, and he did a very good job of laying things out for both the CCA counties and CPO counties. CPO counties are mostly outstate counties. There's 27 of us. We're smaller. We're more nimble. Okay. We can implement strategies, policies, programs far quicker than Washington County, Hennepin, Ramsey. All we have to do is get the approval of the judge or the lead judge in our county. And if it's going to involve money, we've got to get a little involvement from the county board. But we do things quite quickly. We're very, very much involved in evidence-based best practices, motivational interviewing, risk needs testing. We're very much on the front side of that. That, to answer your question, is part of how we reduce future prison beds is through using evidence-based best practices in the juvenile correctional system and the adult correctional system on the misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, and felony levels. We supervise an attempt to rehabilitate offenders. We provide information, recommendation to the courts, working in the community to promote programs and prevent crime. Our focus is mostly on adult repeat DWI offenders, domestic offenders. My caseload is first offenders, domestic abuse cases. We do pretrial supervision on misdemeanors, adults, felons. We're very much focused on the local needs. Because our local judges are elected locally, our local commissioners are elected locally, we have to be responsive to those local needs. That's about all I have. Thank you.
Senator Dietzer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to thank both of you because I know the County Corrections Department, they are a big part of the link between local governments and the state, and I know how hard they work. So thank you for all you do. I know from the probation officers it is another high-stress job, and at Hennepin County, Minneapolis, they play a very active role in helping reduce a lot of the, not just recidivism, but also in the local nuisance crimes. I know they've worked a lot with the neighborhood groups in the police departments and the judges, and it's a very holistic approach that they're trying to do to make the neighborhood in certain parts of Minneapolis more livable. To the question on being at the table, I would just make a suggestion because I understand, and it's also a comment kind of, this gets back to pushing, if the state isn't providing more money because you are a Community Corrections Act county, if the state isn't giving more money, it is just pushing that money and those costs down to the local level because, again, there are certain things that I know at Hennepin County that the corrections department and the public safety is eating up more and more of the budget. And so it's that fine balance because you are an equal partner and a big partner in helping make Minnesota livable. And so I would just also urge you to work with your county board and have them push up this way too, because it is a big impact in their budgets. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Hagstrom?
Pardon me?
Anything further you'd like to present to the committee?
No, thank you.
Are there any further questions from the committee of either of these two gentlemen? Well, we do have a few minutes left. Perhaps we can return to the video that the Commissioner Roy had teed up. Take a look at that.
Mr. Chair, thank you again. This initiative, Transition from Prison to the Community, is a national initiative, and it's a model that is being supported by the National Institute of Corrections, and it recognizes how important the time is between 3 months before prison release and that first basic year after release. Lots of offenders fail immediately upon release, and this whole initiative attempts to build coalitions in the community, build partnerships, get offenders poised for success. It's just going to take a couple minutes here, so.
What's up, Troy? Mira, ¿te gusta? ¿Te gusta? Every day is small interactions, and the water dripping on the granite is kind of a good metaphor in the sense that we have a lot of fires that we put out here during the day. Guys having bad days. You know, now guys having good days. They want to share it with somebody other than somebody who's inside with these guys.
The client really starts to buy into the ability that they have control over their actions, that they have control over their thoughts, and they tend to take some pride in that. And how rewarding is that for an agent to see a client really start to think in a different way? And once they start thinking and acting in a different way, you start to see that their attitudes and beliefs start to change. And they start to actually believe in healthy lifestyles, believe in those positive changes.
Field Agent Mike Schomer and Sergeant Steve Sanchez are two of the DOC's top professionals. They are leading the effort to both share their knowledge and learn from others in a new program called Transition from Prison to the Community. Simply put, TPC is a new system that is designed to get every member of DOC's staff working together to help offenders turn their lives around. From prison through supervision,
it's Mike with DOC.
The TPC model will help us ensure that we are part of a coordinated effort to give offenders the best possible chance of being productive citizens after release.
We're fortunate in Minnesota because many of the staff that we have here understand that their role is to help offenders get out and stay out of prison. Really what it is, it's bumping it up a notch. It's taking it to the next level, giving them additional tools that they can use to motivate the offenders to make the necessary changes so when they do get released, their release is successful and they stay in the community.
TPC at its very core is something that we deal with as officers every day here. It's basically the basic fundamentals of this whole place. It's officers engage in conversation with the offenders. We want to see these guys do well. We can't judge these guys. They've already been judged. We're just here to make sure that all the rules are followed. And sometimes it takes some interaction that isn't necessarily always good, but it has to be done.
Actually, we've been pretty much doing this the whole time. There's really nothing new. It's just kind of connecting the dots, so it's a smoother transition for the client from the facility to the community.
TPC is a new way of approaching corrections. As corrections professionals, we will continue to ensure that offenders are safely and securely confined in our institutions and supervised in the field. But under the TPC model, we will also work to motivate offenders to change their behavior. The goals of TPC are to evaluate the risk offenders pose to the community and assess their needs so we can motivate them to change their behavior. To provide a seamless case plan that follows the offender from incarceration through supervision. To effectively intervene to halt negative behavior that leads to unsafe conditions in our facilities and contributes to recidivism. And to reach out to stakeholders like law enforcement and social services agencies. DOC Commissioner Tom Roy says another important aspect of the TPC model is the mandate to constantly evaluate the effectiveness of the work we're doing. By measuring our successes and evaluating areas where improvement is needed, we will foster a culture of excellence.
I think it will take us to another level because it is more strategic, and that word is sometimes overused, but unless you have a plan, unless you have some definition in who does what and what role people play, things can not go as you want them to go. So by adopting the TPC model, we very consciously set meetings, set agendas, and set our future goals, and that is so important if we're going to get things accomplished.
It's all about public safety. That's our ultimate goal. And if we can help the client change his behavior, change his thought process, long term, we're going to increase public safety more so than just worrying about conditions.
I want these guys to go back. 90% of these guys in here are going to be out someday. I don't want to see them come back in again. Some of these guys I've known for 20 years. And with the interactions that I've had with these guys, I want to see them do well. I want to see them go out there and take care of their families. I want to see them pay taxes. I want to see them live life.
Thank you. And I'll entertain any questions if there are any.
All right. Then, Senator Sheeran.
One more question. I was just looking back again at your materials, and I don't remember you saying whether or not there are other sources of revenue for programming for you other than the state. And do you draw down some federal grants, and what kinds of things do you do with those dollars? If that's in here, I can go back and look again because I've been pulled in and out. So,
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do receive federal grants that are targeted, and we have some active reentry grants. We have some chemical dependency grants, and we can summarize those in a document for you and their focus and how much they are and their duration. It's very limited, however.
Thank you, Senator Latsa. I'm just curious to know if those dollars are threatened and then what we will be losing in terms of these support systems. These are tend to be community-based reintegration programs that you're talking about, correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct. And grant funds, no surprise to anybody, have declined significantly over the years. And we feel that we are fairly aggressive in pursuing those grants, but we don't always prevail.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you deal with the sexual offenders, do you find that the client is, how do I put this? Do you find that they can be helped as much as, say, somebody that you're working with chemical dependency, or is that a greater challenge?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I have not ever tried to address sex offenders as a homogeneous group. Sex offenders are from A to Z, from the grandpa first offender to the alley predator. And response to treatment varies just as much. We are, and the public are constantly amazed at the low recidivism rates that were referenced earlier. For a typical sex offender, 3 to 4%. For a more predatory offender, it's about 9 to 10% recidivism rate over a lifetime. We are on the cusp of releasing a pretty robust research paper that our researcher, Dr. Grant Dewey, completed that looked at 105 civilly committed sex offenders, and he ran an actuarial study. And even in that group of very seriously assessed, at least through the court process, found that 36% of those civilly committed sex offenders would recidivate in their lifetime. 9% would recidivate within 4 years. And at our civil commitment task force that I think you heard some testimony on earlier today. Those actuarial studies are being presented as a research backbone to developing future strategies. Treatment works, and especially for sex offenders, but it is a very specialized treatment that has to be supported not only in our institutions, but again, in transitioning into the community.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, as you stated earlier, you've used the 12-step program for those that are chemically dependent. Have you ever used that to help treat, if we call it that, the sex offender? Not in chemical dependency, but in their acting out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall.
Commissioner.
I wish I was as conversant in sexual offender curriculums as you think I should be. There are similar precursors, and a lot of sex offender supervision looks at behaviors that predict problems for sex offenders. And sex offender treatment is oriented on an offender recognizing what those precursors are, criminal thinking patterns, stimulation in the community, and the focus of treatment for sex offenders then is to get that person to recognize those and to talk with them, with therapists, groups, and deal with those things. So there really isn't a 12-step program, but there is a sequence of treatment that is pretty standard throughout this system now.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I only bring it up I was in a discussion with somebody that treats outside of the state sex offenders, and they said that's a program that they found works better than anything else. As long as we're using it with other programs, I would suggest we at least take a look at it. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions or comments? I guess that concludes the presentations today. I'm going to make a couple of brief announcements. One is, again, to remind folks that when we gavel in and out of the Finance Division and the Policy Committee, they're technically two separate meetings, and we can't count your attendance carrying forward from one to the other. So if in the middle of the meeting we transition, you'll have to check back in again, or at least show up again so we can count you as being present for that. And secondly, in that regard, on next Tuesday, we will have the budget overviews for the Department of Human Rights, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and the Private Detectives Board as Finance Division. And when we're concluded with that, we will meet as a Judiciary Policy Committee to hear two of Senator Newman's bills, Senate Files 28 and 84. All right, that concluding the business today, we are adjourned.